The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Teen Vogue. Since today's episode is dated for Thanksgiving Day, our first article from Teen Vogue is titled The First Thanksgiving, Separating Myth from Fact. In this article, Ruth Hopkins, a Lakota Sioux writer, biologist, attorney, and former tribal judge, breaks down the myths and facts about Thanksgiving and early encounters between pilgrims and the Wampanoag. And again, this is by Ruth Hopkins, and this is published November 11th, 2020. Here in the United States, we've all heard the legendary tale of the first Thanksgiving, when pilgrims dined with natives in celebration of a bountiful harvest. It all started in November 1620, when a group of 102 English religious separatists, known as pilgrims, joined by unaffiliated commercial entrepreneurs, arrived on the shores of North America in a ship called the Mayflower, at present-day Cape Cod. They'd planned to settle in Virginia, but were blown 500 miles off course. Unfortunately, like much of U.S. history, the narrative surrounding the landing of the Mayflower and what happened to the English settlers on board has been whitewashed, diluted, or just plain fabricated. On the 400th anniversary of that fabled landing at Plymouth Rock, let's delve into the reality of this famous event by sorting myth from fact. Myth. When the Mayflower arrived at Plymouth Rock, the landscape was devoid of human civilization. Fact. William Bradford, leader of the voyage, declared they discovered the era unpeopled, but when the pilgrims landed, Darius Coombs, co-director of the Plymouth Plantation, says there were some 70 Wampanoag communities in the area and an estimated 100,000 tribal members whose ancestors had been living there for at least 12,000 years. European trade ships had already been visiting the region for 100 years before the Mayflower sailed, but the pilgrims were the first who attempted to stay. In truth, upon disembarking, the pilgrims were met with cleared fields and fresh water. The Wampanoag had moved to winter camp, but the pilgrims were aware of ongoing indigenous occupation because they dug up and used some of the Wampanoag's food stores. Myth. Pilgrims took pity on indigenous people and fed them. Fact. The pilgrims had no idea how to survive in the new land. They would have starved to death during the severe 1620 to 1621 winter if it weren't for the Wampanoag. They shared their provisions with the colonists and taught them how to hunt, fish, farm, and preserve food in their new environment. As Wampanoag Nana Pashamet said, "We have lived with this land for thousands of generations, fishing in the waters, planting and harvesting crops, hunting the four-legged and winged beings, and giving respect and thanks for each and everything taken for our use. We were originally taught to use many resources, remembering to use them with care, respect, and with a mind toward preserving some for the seven generations of unborn, and not to waste anything." Myth. Thanksgiving was the name of the harvest feast pilgrims and indigenous people shared. Fact. While pilgrims did share a meal with the Wampanoag people, it wouldn't have been possible without their native teachers, and it wasn't called Thanksgiving either. Harvest feasts were a tradition that natives had observed for time immemorial. So it is native generosity that is the basis for the Americanized idea of Turkey Day. The origins of the holiday's modern name are actually quite grisly. Pilgrims and other European invaders warred with the Wampanoag and other local tribes after they settled in. An official day of Thanksgiving kept in all the churches for our victories against the Pequots was proclaimed by Massachusetts Bay Governor William Bradford in 1637, and it was meant to memorialize the slaughter of about 700 Pequot men, women, and children. Myth. The indigenous people who interacted with pilgrims are extinct. Fact. The Mashpee Wampanoag people who first encountered the pilgrims were subjected to centuries of disease, starvation, and war, but they survived. They still inhabit Massachusetts and eastern Rhode Island, are a federally recognized tribe, and have about 2,600 citizens. Myth. The indigenous people who helped the pilgrims aren't being oppressed anymore. Fact. In spring 2020, just as the Mashpee Wampanoag were getting hit with the COVID-19 pandemic, the Trump administration moved to disestablish their reservation, threatening their very existence. A federal judge found the Trump administration's decision arbitrary and capricious and ordered them to reconsider. In July, the U.S. House of Representatives passed H.R. 7608. It is an appropriations bill, but it includes an amendment that would stop the Interior Department from taking the Mashpee Wampanoag's land. The legislation now awaits a Senate vote. The Wampanoag are also seeking the return of the Wampum Belt of Metacom, one of their 17th century chiefs. When he was killed in the 1670s, his belt was sent to King Charles II as a spoil of war. To the Wampanoag, the Wampum Belt is comparable to the crown jewels. Wampum is comprised of purple and white shells from whelks and quahog, and plays a critical role in the tribe's culture. According to the Washington Post, the whereabouts of Metacom's belt is currently not known. Myth. While colonization was an ugly chapter in American history, it's over now. Fact. Tribes in the United States are still dealing with the fallout of colonization, including the same indigenous groups that helped the people survive. As Malcolm X said of the Black experience in the United States, "We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. The rock was landed on us." On Thanksgiving Day, 1970, the 350th anniversary of the Mayflower landing, natives took back Plymouth Rock. Frank James, Wamsutta, Wampanoag, gave a speech that discussed the suffering of his people that his people had endured after the arrival of the pilgrims, and said that while many consider it a day of celebration, to this country's indigenous, it was a day of mourning. He then led a protest on Coles Hill near Plymouth Rock, close to a replica of the Mayflower and a statue of the Wampanoag leader, Massasoit. American Indian Movement, or AIM, leader Russell Means also spoke, and other AIM members boarded a replica of the Mayflower and later buried Plymouth Rock in dirt and refuse. That night, another AIM leader, John Trudell, returned and painted it red. Since then, natives and their allies continue to gather on Coles Hill in Plymouth on Thanksgiving Day to commemorate a national day of mourning. To many natives in the United States, Thanksgiving is a reminder of the genocide of millions of indigenous ancestors and the theft of our lands because of colonialism. It's become a way to honor our dead as well as protest the continuing racism and tyranny that we are being subjected to even now. There are still natives who host family meals during this season, but that is because we've always held harvest feasts long before the pilgrims' arrival. Tribes are still under attack today. Natives live with historical trauma, crushing poverty on reservations, a lack of adequate health care, racism, police brutality, voter suppression, little representation, an epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women, and toxic pipelines being forced through our lands, among other pressing issues. We are still fighting for our treaties to be honored, for our human rights, and for our survival. Perhaps the holiday, like this country, can be salvaged. We shouldn't celebrate genocide, but we can honor those who were killed, elevate Native voices, and embrace that spirit of generosity that Indigenous people shared with the pilgrims. We can feed the hungry and shelter the homeless, and fund and advocate for Native causes and organizations. We can use this day to teach history rather than hide it. Instead of forcing school children to partake in embarrassing Thanksgiving plays based on ugly stereotypes and colonial fiction, Native speakers and historians can come and educate them about Native culture. We can make this world what we want it to be. Create a more perfect union. The next article is titled, Kamala Harris Cracked the Glass Ceiling for Indian American Teens. Now we're ready to shatter it. This is by Meera Patel, published November 12, 2020. In this op-ed, Meera Patel explains what Vice President-elect Kamala Harris means for Indian American teens like her. As a child, my favorite part of dinner time was the chance to stare at my president's placemat, running my fingers over the list of 44 presidents and flipping the laminated sheet to peer at the list of vice presidents. I attempted to imagine what it looked to be the leader of my country. But at age nine, my sense of patriotism was dimmed by my identity crisis. Looking at the placemat, I was drowned in a sea of white men. That was all I knew, because it was all I could see. I questioned whether there would ever be a place for my picture. On November 7th, 2020, not only did I celebrate my 18th birthday, I joined many in welcoming the new president and vice president-elect. As cities across the country came together to celebrate President Donald Trump's defeat, the day was bittersweet for me. 9 years had passed since I was that little girl questioning what I could accomplish solely based on my identity and what I looked like. It felt surreal watching Kamala Harris, dressed in all white, give her acceptance speech. I've taken neither her nomination nor its historic significance lightly. But even as I watched her walk across the stage, I couldn't help but think about the work we still have to do. This win took so long, and it's just the beginning. In the words of Indian American television host Padma Lakshmi, representation matters. The importance of having someone in the White House who looks like you cannot be overstated. I've long wondered how my perception of the world would be different if I saw an Indian American woman on my placemat when I was younger. In Harris's acceptance speech, she explains how her immigrant mother, Shamala Gopalan Harris's values have shaped her mantra. While I may be the first woman in this office, I will not be the last. Because every little girl watching tonight sees that this is a country of possibilities. I believe that there is an unbelievable amount of untapped potential in the first and second generation teenage girls who have long been discouraged by leadership that does not look like them. Through representation like this, our struggles are recognized and our strides are better appreciated. The confidence we gain inspires us to play a part in changing the world. Harris reminds those of us who come from different cultures that our perspectives are an asset. When I was younger, when asked about my dream job, I always responded that I wanted to be the President of the United States. It's always sounded like a far-off pipe dream. Not anymore. To me, this election is proof of an evolving America. An America that will continue to elect children of immigrants, people of color, and women who are representative of our melting pot. Harris's nomination has not only armed me with the courage to go forth and be the first to do many things, but it has also strengthened my commitment to making sure that I won't be the last. I commend her strength and boldness and the way that she pridefully recognizes where and who she came from makes me extra appreciative of my mother and grandmother. In her speech, she encourages others to dream with ambition and lead with conviction. Leaders like her make that possible for young girls like myself. If I, my younger sister, or any other young woman choose to pursue a career in politics, we won't have to try as hard to imagine what our faces would look like on that placemat. As for now, Harris's response to Mike Pence in their debate, "Mr. Vice President, I'm speaking," has inspired me to finish what I have to say. I'm so thankful that this country came together to not just remove a divisive man who spewed hateful rhetoric, but also to elect a qualified woman of color into an incredibly powerful position. But like that of all politicians, Harris's record is not perfect. There has even been debate among Indian Americans about the role her identity plays. However, dissent is patriotic, and she should be held accountable. Despite this, we must recognize that the constructive criticism she should and will receive is different from sexist, racist attacks. And when people like Senator David Perdue repeatedly mispronounce her name, I hope Americans correct him and stand up for her. Kamala Harris is the first female Indian and Black Vice President of the United States, and the fact that she won't be the last is not up for debate. Her nomination alone is a huge win for all Americans and enables young girls across the country to dream bigger. Harris has revealed that America can be a country that represents everyone and that can be bettered by everyone. I look forward to the day that we can proudly say that the glass ceiling is shattered, not cracked. Hopefully, this next victory is right around the corner. And here's another article about a first. Representative Maurie Turner's historic win is a victory for the whole community. By Brittany McNamara on November 11th, 2020. Representative Maurie Turner didn't know they were the first openly non-binary person elected to a state legislature until after they won. It wasn't until people started congratulating Turner and telling them how much it means to see a queer, Black, Muslim, non-binary person in a position of power that the significance really set in. When the messages started to flood in from people across the world who are also non-binary and Black, or non-binary and Muslim, or non-binary and queer, all of these intersections, that was a really humbling experience, Turner told Teen Vogue. On November 3rd, Turner won their seat in Oklahoma's State House for District 88, making them the first Muslim elected to Oklahoma's legislature, the first non-binary person in state office in the country, and one of many LGBTQ candidates whose victory earned them a spot in history books during the 2020 election. For Turner, who said they were motivated to run mainly by a desire for criminal justice reform, their historic win is much more than a personal victory. It's a boon in their community. And for the many young people like them across the world who can finally see that they belong in politics. My Win says politics is a place for you. A lot of younger folks told me I was thinking about going into politics, but I wasn't sure because I don't see folks who look like me. I think one of the major things my victory says is that you can show up, Turner said. We don't need allies to do that for us. We can show up for ourselves. For young people who dream of being in politics, seeing someone who looks like them or shares identities with them can be a motivator to take action. On the flip side, not seeing that representation could be a barrier. But that wasn't the case for Turner, mostly because they never hoped to be a politician. In fact, they were studying to become a veterinarian when their call to public service came. It was around my junior year of college. At this point in time, I was interning at CAIR, Oklahoma. I was the government affairs intern. We had put on the annual gala, and I got a call from my great uncle, who told me that my dad, my Baba, had a bad automobile accident, Turner said. He ended up in the hospital right across the street from the event. This was the first time I'd been able to sit with my Baba and have a real conversation with him in about 8 years since he'd been released from prison. Through these conversations, Turner said they realized the flaws in the Oklahoma criminal justice system and became determined to make a change. At first, they were looking for others to run. When the people they were asking turned the question around on them, Turner said they had to answer the call. Once they decided to run, that's when Turner said concerns about their identity crept in. I think the thought, first and foremost, was being Muslim and running. I was worried because I know the things we go up against, Turner said. But when you step into that political arena, things change real fast. I was worried about that for myself and my family. Across the country, anti-Muslim activity has surged since 2015, tracking closely with political elections that include anti-Muslim sentiment, according to a 2018 report from the New America Foundation. To see how this impacts Muslim politicians, One need look no further than the intense Islamophobia constantly launched at Representatives Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, I believe. While Turner worried hate against them would ratchet up because of their run, they also saw their years of experience living at the intersection of multiple marginalized identities as preparation. I have lived being a Black, Muslim, queer, non-binary person for the majority of my life. The curveballs that were thrown at me were things I had already navigated on some level, they said. My identity prepared me more and empowered me in some sense. It definitely made the rough patches easier to get through. Now that they've weathered the campaign, Maury Turner is ready to get to the real work. They spoke quickly and with excitement about why they want to enact criminal justice reform and take steps to protect local infrastructure like power and gas lines, not just for wealthy communities, but for all citizens in their district. While Turner speaks with knowledge and confidence about complicated issues now, they stressed that they hope their win will not just send a message that anyone belongs in politics, but that anyone who wants to and can get involved. They didn't have loads of money, intricate knowledge about power lines, or even a lifelong desire to run. But they did have a sense of duty and a hunger for change. I had to trust my community when they asked me to run, and I had to put more faith in them than I did in myself. I want to hammer away at the importance of getting involved. We should not and cannot make decisions about people's everyday lives without input from those communities, Turner said. It's time to get involved, and people can train you for anything. And briefly before we close, Maren Morris celebrated Black women country artists in CMA speech. This is by P. Claire Dotson, November 12, 2020. Maren Morris took home the 2020 CMA Award for Female Vocalist and used her platform to subtly call attention to the lack of industry recognition country music gives Black women musicians in the genre. During her speech, Maren celebrated Black women who came before her and who are making music currently. I have a lot of people to thank, and they're the typical ones that lift me up and make this dream come true with me, Maren said. But there are some people in my mind that I want to give recognition to because I'm just a fan of their music, and they're as country as it gets. I just want all of them to know how much we love them back, she continues. Check out their music after this. It's Linda Martell, Yola, Mickey Guyton, Rissy Palmer, Brittany Spencer, Rhiannon Giddens. There are so many amazing Black women that pioneered and continue to pioneer this genre, and I know they're going to come after me. And they've come before me, but you make this genre so, so beautiful. Maren has been an advocate for representation in country music. She has often called out sexism in male artists' songs and urged country radio to play women regularly and take them seriously. Black women in the genre, meanwhile, have continued to call attention to the racism they experience. Mickey Guyton, who Maren name-checked in her speech, has been releasing great country music since 2014, and most recently put out a song called Black Like Me. Hopefully, we'll see more Black country musicians winning at award shows and being recognized for the work that has built and shaped the genre all the way back to its origins. Maren concluded her speech with one final message to those artists. I hope you know that we see you. Thank you for making me so inspired as a singer in this genre. The article also notes that in an interview with NPR, Mickey Guyton talked about how she played by Nashville's rules to no avail. I did Nashville the Nashville way for so long, and I had seen so many women do Nashville the Nashville way with very little results. And that's kind of how I felt within my own life as being a Black woman, she said. Okay, we've run out of time for today's episode of Teen Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. Hope you have enjoyed it. I'm Bahati Mutisia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.